Hold your fire! Hold your fire!
On July 23rd, 1816, the Battle of Negro Fort reached a critical turning point. Under a flag of truce, American Allied Creeks, exhausted from almost a week of fighting, plodded through the thick humidity of the Florida woods. They approached an intimidating fort atop a high bluff along the Apalachicola River. As they neared the imposing citadel, a formidable figure came into their view over the walls of the fort.
Garcon, a 30-year-old carpenter and commander of the fort, observed the American gunboats raise the white flag and deploy their Creek allies to negotiate the fort's surrender. Formerly enslaved and with a Francophone name, Garcon likely hailed from a French colony in the Americas. Like other formerly enslaved people, Garcon found freedom at the fort and refused to surrender it at all costs. A week of combat against the Americans demonstrated his successful defense of the fort and its autonomy as the Americans struggled to advance up the bluff. Unsurprisingly then, Garcon ridiculed the Americans' demand for the fort's surrender, scolding the Creeks as they returned to the American gunboats.
From the river below, the Americans watched a red flag ascend through the clouds of smoke that lingered over the looming fort. Garcon decided to raise the red flag of no surrender to signal that he and the fort's inhabitants preferred to fight to the death rather than live in bondage.
This choice came at a cost.
I am Sebastian Garcia.
I am John Lancaster.
And this is the Memory of Negro Fort podcast.
Episode 1, Destroying.
The Memory of Negro Fort podcast tells the story of how and why Americans have remembered and erased the memory of the largest autonomous community of runaway enslaved people and Native Americans in the history of the United States. To begin uncovering the memory of this free community that American statesmen and soldiers labeled Negro Fort, we must first understand its history. History refers to the reconstruction of the past through critical analysis of surviving records. It is therefore rooted in the concrete and is determined to represent past events authentically. Memory, on the other hand, is rooted in the present, always evolving and subject to both remembering and forgetting. After an historical event occurs, its memory begins as various groups and people remember or forget aspects of it to fit their own worldviews. In July 1816, Negro Fort stood at the intersection between several larger histories, including the legacies of frontier violence between Native Americans and white settlers in the 18th century, the War of 1812 and its goals of American expansion, escalating frictions between the United States and Spanish-controlled Florida, and the growing reliance on enslaved labor in the American South during the early 19th century. The fort's creation was a product of the War of 1812, a conflict that equally centered on these historical issues of violence on the southern frontier between white settlers and indigenous people, and the U.S. desire to expand the institution of slavery into territories like Florida. At the same time, the ideological creation of the site as Negro Fort reflected the growing racial hierarchy of the early republic, as the community of free black and indigenous people who lived there undermined the new nation's social order. The persisting memory and sometimes oblivion of Negro Fort underlines the importance that issues like race, national identity, power, and violence have had on the history of the United States. These issues were first contested, however, on the literal grounds of the site during the Battle of Negro Fort, which occurred between July 15 and July 27, 1816. Garcon's decision to hoist the red flag of no surrender on July 23rd raises several questions about the United States and its relationship with slavery in the decades following independence. Why was Garcon so determined to fight to the death during the Battle of Negro Fort? How did the historical realities of the world in which Garcon, the fort's inhabitants, and belligerents lived in influence their decision to fight to the death?
Why did the newly formed United States, heirs to the Enlightenment ideals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, vie for the destruction of a community that carried out those very same ideals?
To begin answering these questions, we must go back to the nation's founding, particularly the drafting of the Constitution.
The Constitution is rightly considered a pro-slavery document, but even in that document, the word slave is not used intentionally. Matthew Clavin, I'm a professor of history at University of Houston in Houston, Texas. There was a concerted effort not to make slavery permanent or, you know, to concretize it in that document. And so it kind of just reflects that a lot of the founders, early Americans in general, even slave owners, were very conflicted over the idea of human bondage. It was very much a part of many areas in the United States, but even the most prominent slave owners were uncomfortable with it. Over half the people who signed the Constitution were slave owners, yet I'd say almost all of them have been documented with their anti-slavery views. But before you get excited and think that a lot of them were really opposed to slavery, it's one thing to express anti-slavery opinions, but there's another thing to do anything against it. And people like Thomas Jefferson owned hundreds of people, talked repeatedly about the evils of slavery. When he's president, he signs into law the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade. But his idea of abolition was tied in with the idea of colonization, this racist idea that even if we are to free these African-American slaves, they need to be exiled from the country. It's very complicated and it's all over the place. It's very inconsistent. And I know it's hard for people to fathom today, but to have a slave owner who's anti-slavery, it seems paradoxical to us, but it was quite common back then. But also paradoxical is the idea that you feel that these people should be free, but because of their blackness, they can't live here in the United States. So certainly in the Revolutionary era and shortly thereafter, almost every slave owner is conflicted over the idea of owning people.
By the 1810s, this moral ambivalence to slavery eroded as Southern planters increasingly viewed the potential for large-scale profit through enslaved labor. The expansion of slavery required more land to cultivate cash crops like cotton, tobacco, sugar, and rice. This appetite for land to grow the institution of slavery clashed with indigenous populations that already inhabited the quickly expanding frontier regions of the early republic.
Southerners are fighting against indigenous peoples fairly regularly between the American Revolution and the American Civil War in this antebellum period. I'm Evan Noe. I'm an assistant professor of history at University of South Carolina, Lancaster, and I am also the historian for our campus's Native American Studies Center. Some family histories that will be passed down through generations that will say, we moved here from the east out into the rugged wilderness, set up a homestead, and then we were attacked by Indians. Where it goes from there is usually retaliatory violence from their perspective against indigenous people. Native Americans are defending their homes, and then settlers are using that as justification to further displace indigenous people.
One of the most well-known and persisting stories that many white Southerners continue to point to during the early 19th century as further justification for Indian removal and settler expansion was the Hampton Family Massacre. In 1773, Anthony Hampton and his wife, Anne Elizabeth, settled in the recently organized 96th District in modern-day upstate South Carolina. 7 years before, Cherokee and South Carolina colonial officials delineated the land between Indian and settler territory.
They set up what's referred to as the Indian border, basically this buffer zone in which the Cherokee are supposed to stay west of this line and settlers are supposed to stay east of this line. The Hamptons and several others move basically right into this buffer zone that's supposed to be unoccupied. His adult children are engaged in the deerskin trade, often trading with indigenous people in this market exchange economy. But we see that there are further attempts by colonists to acquire large tracts of Cherokee land. So much so that it's going to push basically a faction of the Cherokee to defend themselves. They had several times already had settlers basically kicked out of their property. They have worked with colonial officials to do this. They had done it by themselves to do this. But they basically feel they've been pushed too far when there's this effort by colonists to make a massive land purchase actually west of the Appalachian Mountains. So we see conflict break out basically simultaneously with the American Revolution, where the Cherokee are going to defend their borders against colonial encroachment. And the Hamptons, being in an area where they're not supposed to be in the first place, are going to be early casualties of the Cherokee War of 1776.
Their deaths were witnessed by their daughter and son-in-law, Elizabeth Hampton and James Harrison, who watched the violence unfold behind a bush. From their perspective, the engagement supposedly started cordial. Elizabeth's dad, Anthony, shook hands with one of the Cherokee warriors. Her brother, Preston, recognized the other Cherokee warrior, probably from his work in the deerskin trade. In a matter of seconds, however, Elizabeth saw
the very hand which Mr. Hampton, my father, had, but for a moment grasped in friendship, now sent a tomahawk into his skull.
Her mother suffered a similar fate, as a Cherokee struck her in the head with a tomahawk. Her brother Preston fell after the sound of a gunshot. Perhaps worst of all was the death of Elizabeth and James's unnamed infant son. Cherokee warriors, according to the Hamptons' retelling, rammed the small child against the wall of the house,
which spattered with its blood and brains.
Shocked from the scene unfolding before them, unable to look away, Elizabeth and James watched the Cherokee set fire to the house before leaving the settlement. The aftermath left, as remembered by the Hampton family,
mangled bodies lay scattered to and fro in the yard with fiendish malignity.
And while this initial wave of Cherokee resistance is successful, there is going to be a brutal backlash by the colonists, and they're going to work together from Virginia to Georgia to basically take the fight into the Cherokee's nation and are going to bring not just war and devastation, but dispossession as well. When the South Carolinians, for instance, when the North Carolinians, for instance, invade Cherokee country, they're not just trying to win battles on a battlefield. They are going to destroy Cherokee towns. They're going to destroy food supplies. They are going to destroy fields. All of this is not just an act to defeat an enemy in battle, but it is an effort to try and eliminate a people's ability to live in their towns. And we're going to see that by the end of the Cherokee War of 1776, that South Carolina in particular is going to take almost all of the territory that the Cherokee claimed within the South Carolina at that point state.
Tensions between Native people and white settlers worsened in the decades following American independence, especially on the southern frontier. White Southerners grew sour with the federal government as they increasingly looked for help settling on indigenous lands.
State governors will often be very critical of federal agents or the federal government at large, or in some instances, even the president specifically, that they essentially aren't doing enough to either remove indigenous peoples or provide protection for settlers moving into what is often disputed territories. So we have all of these examples, of which the Georgia-Muskogee border in the 1790s is particularly tense. There's often sort of raids going back and forth, much of it precipitated by Georgia settlers trying to seize indigenous land under illegitimate treaties. And then when they move into indigenous space and the Muskogee attempt to defend their territory, there's going to often be a cry from Georgia at large that the federal government isn't doing enough to provide protection for settlers or to keep indigenous people in check from their perspective. So this becomes an issue that will again have immediate consequences when these acts of violence play out.
The attack of Isaac Brown's Georgia homestead by Muskogee Creeks in 1797 fueled this growing outcry from Georgia settlers and white Southerners at large to enact vengeance and reprisals against indigenous communities.
Isaac Brown and his family are living in this disputed territory not far from the Oconee River, and they are going to be attacked by a group of Uchi Indians who are living among sort of the broader Creek Confederacy. And it is going to be a pretty brutal assault, not unlike the assault against the Hampton homestead. And it is going to become one that's very well documented as well. Uchi Indians raid the Brown homestead. They end up killing Isaac Brown. There is going to be Colonel Lawson, this individual sort of coming and helping the surviving family members escape. Where things become probably even a bit more salacious than just the death of Isaac Brown is that when a larger company of militia return to the homestead to recover and bury the body, they find the body's been mutilated. The head has been decapitated and is missing, presumably taken as a war trophy. So this is going to, again, be another one of these instances in which Georgians will become irritable, will become agitated, will call for reprisals. What ends up happening is that local Creek leaders are going to be able to track down an individual Uchi who's thought to be responsible and put them to death and try and keep basically this punishment of indigenous people by indigenous people to try and de-escalate conflict.
The justice brought by local Creek leaders was not enough for Isaac's surviving wife, Mary Brown. She successfully petitioned the state of Georgia for financial compensation and state assistance, as memories of her rushing to secure the door after Isaac fell to the second gunshot, of the Creek Indians attempting to break through the door with brute force, and of her ultimately seizing her deceased husband's gun and firing upon the Creeks, left Mary in a distressed and helpless condition. As her Georgia representative claimed, the traumatic memories rendered her
incapable of affording necessary assistance to her children, and therefore cries to your honorable body to alleviate her and her weeping orphan sufferings by affording her and them some small assistance.
When one of her children, Isaac Brown Jr., came of age in the 1810s, Mary passed on these memories to obtain further retribution for her deceased husband, telling Brown Jr.,
"Isaac, my son, the Indians killed your father and may kill you, but I'd rather hear of your being killed than to hear that my son had acted a coward."
That Mary preferred her son dying in pursuit of blood revenge more than anything else highlighted the deep lacerations between white and indigenous communities in the southern frontier at the turn of the 19th century. Individuals like Isaac Brown Jr. and the Hampton descendants carried these one-sided, fashioned recollections about their family's past when they fought in the War of 1812.
Like the Browns and Hamptons, many Americans viewed this large-scale conflict as an opportunity to simultaneously displace indigenous communities from the South and expand the institution of slavery deeper into the area, precisely in places like Florida. Yet, one glaring obstacle stood in the way of white Southerners attempting to accomplish both objectives. Florida was controlled by the Spanish. Negro Fort's contemporary obscurity partly comes from the fact that it existed within the context of the War of 1812, a conflict equally overshadowed and misunderstood. The war meant more than Francis Scott Key's Defense of Fort McHenry poem, which later became the Star-Spangled Banner, and the spectacle of the British incineration of Washington, D.C. It was a war that carried considerable ramifications for all combatants involved, including the westward and southward-looking Americans, the British, the Spanish, and the indigenous and black people who fought for their freedom. It was a war that led to the creation of the largest autonomous community of escaped enslaved people and Native Americans in the history of the United States.
The War of 1812 is still one of those things which is habitually understudied, always overshadowed by the American Revolution. The War of 1812 is intensely significant for multiple different reasons. My name is Nathaniel Millett. I'm an associate professor of history at St. Louis University. I'm also the editor of a journal called Atlantic Studies. American settlers, enslavers are kind of moving in to Alabama and Mississippi and in places like this that are in the proximity of Spanish Florida, but they're doing so while being kind of uneasy. They're moving in because they're greedy and they want to expand and they want land, but they're scared of Seminoles, they're scared of Creeks, they're scared of Red Sticks, they're scared of the kind of lingering British presence out of the Caribbean. And the War of 1812 to Southerners is a pristine opportunity to knock out the Spanish in Florida and to end this threat to the expansion of slavery.
Florida is just very much beauty in the eye of these southern slave-owning, land-owning beholders. And they have these incredible visions and dreams of acquiring Florida, not only to extend their plantation culture, but to control the waterways. And they can ship their cotton through a lot of these bodies of water that stream from across the south into the Gulf of Mexico. And so there's just an economic component to this.
This dream came with a deep fear, however, of what Spanish Florida held, especially for the subjugated peoples of the United States, namely a non-Anglo, non-Protestant, multiracial, and multi-ethnic society that undermined the growing racial rigidity of the United States.
There's also this idea that Spanish Florida, it's non-Anglo, it's non-Protestant. There's such a great number of native people, increasingly runaway slaves. And so this totally runs counter to, again, the dreams and visions of these Southern slave owners. And so this border is a place of fear and concern for Southern slave owners. And they want to not only secure the border, but ultimately eliminate it by making Florida a part of the United States.
To American slaveholders across the colonial and early national period, their single greatest fear is slave rebellion. And accordingly, white Southerners believe in the essential imperative nature of creating these acutely, rigidly hierarchical, racialized societies, which are also acutely patriarchal. I mean, a lot of power and control in the hands of prominent white men, enslavers, officials, militia leaders, oftentimes the same person in all three cases. And their job is to keep everyone in check, to keep enslaved people from undermining this, native people as well, who are considered kind of transgressive and not quite fitting neatly in this hierarchy. Their freedom, their mobility, their autonomy in native people, their willingness sometimes to work with, to shelter, to live with formerly enslaved Africans, but also to enslave and entrap down in Hunt is troubling to white Southerners. And then in turn, Spanish Florida kind of ties all of this up. It is a large place which is largely uncontrolled by imperial white authorities. It is a bastion for fugitive slaves. The society there, indigenous people and free and enslaved African people, have more autonomy than they do in an American, North American, Anglo-American plantation society. All of this seems like a dangerously bad example to people to the north. And white Southerners look at anything that might encourage disobedience, challenging this racialized hierarchy as being dangerous. The young United States agrees by and large and looks at the challenge of Spanish Florida as almost a national security threat.
Everybody wanted to take Florida. From the beginning, they didn't like the idea that the Spaniards were there. I'm Jane Landers. I'm the Gertrude Conway Vanderbilt Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. They used all sorts of derogatory language about them and so on. The Anglos to the north, I'm speaking of. That expansionist mode that the Americans were committed to, get those Spanish papists, as they would call them, out of there. So everybody's trying to get the Spanish out. And Spain is weakened by this time. It's not the great imperial wealthy power it once was. It's spread thin, and it's experiencing revolutions against its monarchy, too, that will weaken it, which means it can't supply its colonies the way it used to. It can't enforce the law the way it used to. It can't defend. It can't do a lot of things. And that makes it more unstable, too. It's in that turmoil that 1812 happens. Then you could say the Creek Wars happen. And then you could say Negro Ford happens. And that some of the same people are involved in all of those episodes, too.
An enslaved person named Polydor was one of several individuals whose life intersected with the events of the War of 1812, and by extension, Negro Fort. Initially enslaved at Andrew Jackson's Hermitage Plantation, Polydor escaped his bondage as a child by heading south to Spanish Florida. Like many enslaved blacks before him, Polydor saw a path within the Spanish system to secure his freedom that did not exist in the United States.
He was a young boy when his parents used that religious sanctuary policy to cross the Georgia line into Florida. And by the old principles that Spain held, If someone comes seeking the true faith of Catholicism, you are required to receive them and shelter them and free them if they are coming under that guise or under that reason. And so he comes in as a young boy. He gets educated because he's placed with a very important Spanish official. So he's literate. And he is someone who, when the British come rolling into town in redcoats recruiting runaways, he runs with them to Negro Fort.
The opportunity to receive education, freedom of the mind, and freedom of movement that existed in Spanish Florida terrified white American Southerners and their ambitions to expand slavery and dehumanize black people.
And this is why the expansionist drive happens. They want to get free people out of there, especially if they're black, because they don't want that example if they're trying to install a chattel slavery plantation system, expand it from South Carolina into Georgia, into Florida. This kind of a person is very, very dangerous to them or threatening to them, and they would try to eliminate those people.
The person from whom Polydor escaped, Andrew Jackson, led the Americans' effort during the War of 1812 to capture Spanish Florida, to not only eliminate people like Polydor, but to ensure that a place where people like him could seek freedom ceased to exist.
He's from Tennessee. He's from South Carolina. He's from that bifurcated South where there's white supremacy and there's black slavery. And Florida is just completely different. Slave people had rights they didn't in the English-speaking world. In Florida, there are Native Americans with land and guns and power. There are a lot of escaped slaves. There's the Spaniards who seem to get along with these black people. There's a large free black populations in St. Augustine and Pensacola. So for Jackson, he always sees Spanish Florida as just an obstacle to the dreams of white Southerners. We, the United States, need Florida to make more money for slave owners to grow more cotton and ship more cotton. But then there's also this idea that this multiracial world of Spanish Florida is undermining what white Southerners are establishing north of the Spanish border. Like I said, the white supremacy, the black slavery. Going back to Thomas Jefferson, a lot of the founding fathers had their eyes on Spanish Florida, but none of them were talking about a military invasion or anything like that. Jackson is one of the first that he really helps get the ball rolling that we're going to get Spanish Florida. And if we have to do it violently, well, then we'll do that.
Jackson first needed to defeat the Creek Nation, which in his view stood as a dangerous threat and obstacle in reaching the southern border of Spanish Florida and securing the land of present-day Alabama and Georgia. A major general in the Tennessee militia, Jackson leveraged the frontier violence that erupted between Tennesseans and Creek Indians in May 1812 to call for a full-scale invasion into Creek lands.
The Duck River Raid basically occurs at about the same time that the War of 1812 is escalating with the British. There had been several violent interactions between Tennesseans and the Muscogee Creek as Tennessee settlers are pushing into indigenous spaces. So we see the Duck River Raid being one of these more salacious events in which multiple people are killed as a result of a Creek raid against this settlement. Again, a settlement that is in ambiguous territory, whether they're supposed to be there or not. Probably not. But what we see happening is this becomes fodder for people like Andrew Jackson to advocate for a wholesale invasion of the Creek Confederacy. Basically drive down south into what is today modern-day Alabama. And he uses a very sort of fire and brimstone approach to describing what he thinks that the Tennesseans should do to the Muscogee. He talks about exterminating towns.
I shall penetrate the Creek towns.
He talks about enslaving women and children as captives as a result.
I shall lead into captivity their wives and children.
Makes it very clear that he doesn't want to just avenge these deaths. He wants to put an end to a people.
I shall lay waste to their villages. I shall burn their houses. I shall kill their warriors.
Throughout 1813 and 1814, Jackson committed these acts of violence against a militant faction of Creeks called the Red Sticks, who broke away from other Creeks that viewed American assimilation, rather than fighting to the death, as the most effective way to retain their land.
The Creek are divided by the time of the War of 1812. Roughly half the Creeks are kind of loyal to the United States out of desperation. But then there's half of the Creeks who are completely militant and militarized, and they do not want to give away another acre of land to the United States. And they're just labeled the Red Sticks. They just carry these war clubs. They painted red before battle. And these people will fight to the death, and they will align with slaves if they have to. So Jackson, going back to the American Revolution, he's known Native Americans his entire life. He's a frontier kid. He doesn't like Native Americans. And so by the time of the War of 1812, he comes to despise Native people, especially those who show any form of resistance. And so he's ready to escalate the United States' war on Native people, as long as it benefits not only him, but people like him, the southern United States, and even just the country nationally by expanding its borders.
On August 30th, 1813, the Red Sticks launched their greatest military victory during the war. The attack targeted Fort Mims in the Tensaw District in present-day southern Alabama. Defeat for the Americans came in a matter of a few hours. The Red Sticks spared none in this brutal assault.
It is such a wholesale victory for the Red Stick Creeks, in which they're attacking an American outpost on Creek territory, resulting in the death of almost 600 settlers who are trying to find protection against this unfolding Indian war that they're now concerned with. But while this is a victory for the Red Sticks, it's going to spark retaliation
by none other than Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson is going to be able to drum up support for an invasion of Creek country, one that he's basically been asking for quite some time. We will see that the federal government will authorize the territorial militia in the Mississippi Territory, and then Georgia and even South Carolina will send militia to fight against the Creek Confederacy. The Tennesseans will eventually be the most successful.
By August of 1814, the Jackson-led American forces and their allied Creeks forced the Red Sticks to surrender with the Treaty of Fort Jackson. The treaty reconstructed the geopolitical status of the American South by granting white Southerners almost 23 million acres of land spanning modern-day Georgia and Alabama.
White Southerners will celebrate not only their own participation, but each other's participation in this conflict. And most significantly for the geopolitical recreation of the South, it's going to seize 23 million acres of Muscogee land. It is going to basically take large swaths of Georgia and central Alabama and hand them over to these newly expanding states. So we see that in the aftermath of this war, settlers are going to move into these territories rapidly.
And as a result, a massive exodus of Creek Indians fled to Spanish Florida, a place that Native Americans and escaped enslaved people continued to transform into their own sanctuary against the encroaching American racial order.
While the Creek War ends in 1814 with the Treaty of Fort Jackson, with the American seizure of millions of acres of indigenous land, that does not mean the conflict is over for everyone. There are going to be refugee Muscogee Creeks who flee into Spanish Florida, who will flee down the Florida Panhandle.
Florida is vast. It is a challenging physical environment in the 19th century, swamps, forests, things like that. It's thinly populated by Spanish imperialists who are limited almost entirely to St. Augustine and then Pensacola. So again, Spanish control is nominal. There is a very, very long-term, multi-century tradition now of people, of enslaved Africans fleeing from the north into the Florida wilderness, sometimes joining Seminoles, sometimes joining Red Sticks. So it's simply a geography that allows for these type of communities to form because of the light imprint of Spanish imperialism. But then it's also clearly a borderlands region in that it is nominally a Spanish territory on the edge of the expanding United States, but real power is indigenous, Seminole, Creek in this region, escaped slaves, people of African ancestry, all of whom have elevated agency, elevated status for people who usually didn't have as much power elsewhere.
Jackson's war on the Creeks forced more Native Americans to find refuge in Spanish Florida, which in turn fueled his desire to invade the foreign territory once and for all. Perhaps more important than fulfilling his promise that
the whole Creek nation shall be covered with blood. Fire shall consume their towns and villages, and their land will be divided among the whites.
The aftermath of the Creek War positioned Jackson directly on the border of Spanish Florida. a literal step away from realizing his larger ambition of securing the peninsula and eliminating an important escape valve for people that did not fit his vision of the United States. His victory against the Creeks, however, also squared him against a man equally emotional, equally intense, equally interested in Spanish Florida, but with a completely different worldview. This man was Edward Nichols.
While Jackson purged Creek lands and enslaved black people, Nichols invited both indigenous and escaped enslaved populations into his military ranks.
When slaves volunteered their services, we, of course, were obliged to accept. I think if I had a corps or detachment of several black regiments, it would have a very good effect. Blacks, I think, would the more readily join us if they saw men of their own color in a state of discipline.
After the British officially declared war on the United States in January 1813, redcoats like Nichols returned to a war strategy they implemented a few decades earlier during the Revolutionary War: recruit and ally themselves with Native Americans and runaway enslaved people to defeat their common enemy, the United States.
The British, as they fight with the Americans, they repeatedly show a willingness to ally themselves with Native peoples. They certainly demonstrate a willingness to ally themselves with fugitive slaves or just enslaved people in general. And so compared to the Americans, the British seem to be the true freedom fighters in North America in the early 19th century. And it's not to say that the British were or was an empire of egalitarianism, but there's enough of it in the American Revolution through the War of 1812 and even after that for Native people, it's their last chance. They'll consider aligning themselves with anybody who can keep them on their land. And they are literally offering freedom to Black Americans who will escape from their owner and join military service for the British. And this guarantees their family not only freedom, but land. And so, obviously, if you are looking for freedom in the late 18th, early 19th century, your only real bet is to join with the British.
The growing multi-ethnic haven of Spanish Florida seemed like an ideal place for the British to execute this war plan.
And by the spring of 1814, the Redcoats constructed a fort along the Apalachicola River near present-day Tallahassee
as a base of operations for a planned invasion of the United States through the American Southeast.
With the War of 1812 being against the United States and the British are going to, at times, actively collaborate with indigenous peoples and with formerly enslaved African Americans who have found freedom in Spanish Florida. We will see that as the war continues on, and moves from just sort of this border conflict between the United States and Canada, looking to a British invasion of the Gulf South. In preparation of that, we're going to see basically British station troops and actually begin trying to arm, supply, and train both indigenous peoples and formerly enslaved black Southerners. So this is where we see the beginning of this fortification at Prospect Bluff along the Apalachicola River. This is effectively a staging ground for potentially an invasion into southern Georgia.
Ultimately, what's happening, spring of 1814, the British are sort of telegraphing what they're going to do. At some point, they're going to try to invade the United States through the Gulf of Mexico. Bottom line is they need a military base to be established before all this can happen. And 15 miles up the Apalachicola River, if you sail northward on the right side, there's a bluff about 15, 20 feet over the water, depending on the level of the water. And originally it was a trading post there. And so the British find this little trading post. There's a handful of slaves. There's some hides that are there, probably some guns being sold, maybe some food and supplies. And they just take it over in the spring of 1814. And although technically controlled by Spain, Florida was extremely insecure. And so, quite frankly, the Spanish were powerless to stop them. And so the British start to recruit Native Americans. They start to entice slaves to escape from their Spanish and increasingly their American owners across the Florida-Georgia border. And they start to clear a massive space on the edge of the river. And then they're going to start to build this huge sort of wooden bastion around it. And so the whole site will be about 5, 6, 7 acres. And then they start to put cannons and they start to, you know, put this redan hanging over the edge of the river for boats to dock at. And the longer they're there, as the days, weeks, and months pass, The number of Black and Indian people who arrive at the fort grows from the dozens to the hundreds to eventually the thousands, low-level thousands. And they are literally on a daily basis chopping down trees, building some stone storage facilities, putting up these wooden barriers around there. They're digging a moat around the entire site, this complex. And so it's just nonstop activity. And the British are overseeing this all. But most of the labor is being done by escaped slaves, Native Americans, and a handful of Royal Marines from England.
As a lieutenant colonel in the British Royal Marines, Nichols oversaw the creation of the British fort at Prospect Bluff.
Edward Nichols is a deeply fascinating character who is central to events at Prospect Bluff. And he was a British Royal Marine who was from Coleraine originally, which is today in Northern Ireland. He comes from a deeply Calvinist family upbringing. He sees action all over the Atlantic world and in the Napoleonic Wars. He is a man of action and deep feelings. And he develops kind of unusual ideology of anti-slavery, given his station and his vocation and his role within the British Empire. And Nichols, by the time he arrives at Prospect Bluff, is acutely anti-slavery and deeply opposed to slavery. He regards it as in a kind of abhorrent moral evil. He thinks in very stark religious terms, acutely Protestant, Calvinistic terms. He believes that slavery can legitimately be fought through violence, even though he is, of course, fighting for a slaveholding empire himself in Great Britain, which doesn't end slavery till 1834. And I think part of what drives Nichols is his own ethnic identity. I mean, he is a Northern Irishman in an English empire, maybe a little insecure about his ethnic identity. And he regards military service as the ultimate equalizer, perhaps for himself, and then in the case of Prospect Bluff, for people of African ancestry. He is given this role of raising Native American Seminole Red Stick troops and American slaves in the Southeast, in the broader plan of the British invasions of the Deep South. He interprets his orders very, very broadly and ends up being at the heart of the creation of this community.
He is a career professional soldier. He's from Ireland. He spends his entire career in the British Marines, basically. And he will eventually go on to do a lot of things that are very anti-slavery, abolitionist even. But when he comes to Florida, he is a genuine anti-slavery radical. And he just has these radical ideas for the time of racial equality. And the story of Negro Fort gets complicated because the British will use Native Americans and African Americans to their advantage. And in some cases, it's not necessarily a bona fide or genuine egalitarianism. Sometimes they might use abolition just to slight the Americans or to gain a strategic advantage. But when you have men like Edward Nichols on the front lines, it's going to change the way things play out. So he's basically in charge of the ground forces at Negro Fort, or at the British post, initially called. And when he invites Native Americans to join the British fight, when he invites enslaved Americans or enslaved Spaniards in Florida to join the British fight, he generally has their best interest in heart. And so he's just one of these radical egalitarians, and he comes to America to primarily fight for the British. But while he's doing that, he wants to spread ideas of British freedom. And we're talking going back to the Magna Carta and the English Constitution and the Glorious Revolution. He doesn't seem to have a racist bone in his body. He seems to be genuinely concerned with the interest of Britain's allies, whether they be Black, Native American.
We're going to see Edward Nichols of the British basically try to work alongside and prepare these Refugee Creek Red Sticks. Certainly work alongside formerly enslaved Black Southerners to basically get them ready in terms of continuing this war.
As Nichols trained his Black and Indigenous troops into a formidable fighting force throughout the spring and summer of 1814, the British formalized their recruitment policy toward enslaved people and Native Americans through a series of public proclamations distributed throughout the American South. In a proclamation issued in April 1814, Alexander Cochrane, the commander-in-chief of the Royal Navy's North American Station, stated,
"Whereas it has been represented to me that many persons now resident in the United States have expressed a desire to withdraw therefrom, with a view of entering into His Majesty's service or of being received as free settlers into some of His Majesty's colonies. This is therefore to give notice that all those who may be disposed to emigrate from the United States will, with their families, be received on board His Majesty's ships or vessels of war, or at the military post that may be established upon or near the coast of the United States, when they will have their choice of either entering into His Majesty's sea or land forces, or of being sent as free settlers to the British possessions in North America or to the West Indies, where they will meet with due encouragement.
When word starts to get around and copies, literally copies of these proclamations are distributed in Maryland, Georgia, the Florida coast, Louisiana, and oftentimes they're given to slaves, sometimes they're given to free black people, they're literally handed out to Native Americans. And United States newspapers will copy some of the text from these things. Sometimes they'll almost photocopy the entire thing or will transcribe it and publish it word for word. So if you are an American citizen in the southern United States, especially if you're a slave owner, and if your fear of some sort of triple alliance of Native Americans, runaway slaves, and Brits was on a scale of 1 to 10, a 3 or 4, and then you read this proclamation, and you're well aware that the British are now on the Florida coast, your fear might escalate to a 9 or 10. Whatever that fear is, it increases significantly when word gets out about these proclamations. Like it is official British policy that they are going to let Native Americans remain where they are. They are going to liberate enslaved people under one condition, that those enslaved people and those Native Americans help the British defeat the Americans by taking American lives. And so even the most disinterested American in the South is going to be very concerned now.
When white American Southerners learned about the man responsible for leading this triple alliance and the rhetoric he used to inspire his troops, their anxieties heightened.
Nichols's language, at least in speeches that survive and in proclamations to his troops and people in the South, is fiery. And it is born from the religious tradition of his youth in Northern Ireland, which would have been austere, dour, hyper-moralistic, intense, very, very intense, Calvinistic. And he speaks in the most unambiguous terms, blood and thunder and death and destruction and things like that. He is unambiguous in his belief that, again, violence is an acceptable means to fight slavery, physical, intellectual violence. And if you are an enslaver or just a white American listening to this and watching his formerly enslaved army grow, etc., you find this incredibly terrifying because it is also emotive and it's meant to be consumed and digested by a non-literate audience. So it is, he doesn't pull his punches and he's saying things like this publicly. It's formerly enslaved people, Native Americans, the Spanish are hearing this and presumably then going back to their communities, sharing it, being emboldened and radicalized. They are theoretically, the Spanish are anti-American and the Spanish are perpetually living in fear of an American invasion after 1800 and especially after the Creek War. And they see in the British guest who they really can't tell to leave, but maybe their best and only hope of keeping the Americans at bay.
An American invasion of Spanish Florida arrived in December 1814. Months after recruiting and mobilizing black and indigenous troops at Prospect Bluff, Nichols and his forces traveled to Pensacola, anticipating an assault led by Andrew Jackson. Jackson viewed his mission from the Creek War as unfinished, since many Red Sticks fled into Spanish Florida and joined Nichols's multiracial and multi-ethnic fighting force.
Also unsatisfied with his egalitarian mission, Nichols saw an opportunity in Pensacola to recruit and free additional enslaved people from the area.
Nichols frees hundreds of American and Spanish Florida enslaved people, particularly in Pensacola. Many flee to Pensacola and are given freedom. And during his time with this growing formerly enslaved population, Nichols seems to inform them of his anti-slavery ideology. They obviously dislike slavery. Of course, course, they resist slavery, they have intense agency, and in that way, he, however, fills in a really important piece by kind of instilling an ideology of anti-slavery, the evils of it, their potential for political inclusion, equality, and he really sits down and talks deeply with hundreds of formerly enslaved people about his understanding of anti-slavery ideology. And then the final piece of the puzzle is, after explaining the unlimited potential for black and white equality, Nichols grants British subjecthood. This is a pretty radical proposition.
But he's also trying to intimidate slave owners and, you know, allies of the United States that we are here to fight. And so what he does is, you know, he publicly drills Native American and African American recruits in the streets. He puts these black Marines in these special uniforms with red hats. You know, it's the standard British red coat, but they have blue pants and a white shirt. You know, Native Americans are dressed in their full warrior gear with the feathers and the weapons and the clubs. And so he makes a public statement by doing this. And so Nichols is trying to show the Americans that we're here to fight and you better be prepared. While Nichols is drilling troops, his multiracial force, the streets of Pensacola, almost mocking American and Spanish slave owners, he gives this legendary speech where he tells these British soldiers that these are your brothers and your sisters. You're going to need to bleed to free these people and let the Native Americans keep their land. And he refers to them as brothers and sisters. And it's not the normal language of a colonial Marine officer in the late 18th or early 19th century. So this is just this incredible case of interracial cooperation. And so these Native Americans, African Americans, these Brits, these soldiers, they have a common enemy in the United States. And under Nichols, they have a common ambition.
This was Jackson's final straw. In a letter to Washington, D.C., Jackson explained that Nichols,
to convince the Spanish governor of his power and prowess, paraded his savage force, marched it through the town, saluting his excellency with the war whoop, and threatening to scalp all the inhabitants.
Pleading that now was the time to invade Pensacola and take Spanish Florida in the process. President James Madison disagreed. He replied to Jackson in unmistakable terms that,
you should at present take no measures which would involve this government in a contest with Spain.
Jackson ignored the president's order.
And as a result, confrontation in Pensacola between Jackson and Nichols carried considerable stakes.
Jackson represents a fight for slavery, a fight for white supremacy, a fight for the expansion of slavery. And what Nichols represents is the complete opposite. He is fighting for the freedom of black people in America. He's fighting for the land of Native Americans. And it represents two amazing possible outcomes.
Andrew Jackson is, he, like Nichols, I think, as well, is kind of driven by his own ethnic identity insecurity. He, too, is a Northern Irishman. His parents are from Northern Ireland. He is born almost immediately after they arrive from Northern Ireland. He grows up in backcountry Carolina, in an almost entirely Northern Irish community, before going to Charleston as a young man, a place which would have been, his ethnic identity would have felt pretty acute in a world which would have been very English, very black, and as a kind of backwoods Ulsterman, he wouldn't have fit. If Nichols compensates for his own ethnic insecurities by a, what you might call, a very progressive, expansive idea of subjecthood and anti-slavery, Jackson does the reverse. He comes up with a very conservative, racialized vision of whiteness. And America is an empire for whites. People of color need to be subjugated, enslaved, destroyed, displaced. So they're kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, two sides of the same coin.
And I would say, unfortunately, the winning side are the slave-owning Southern Americans.
Jackson arrived with an army of about 4,000 militiamen and allied Choctaws, greatly outnumbering Nichols's forces of about 1,000 black Marines, Spanish regulars, and Indian warriors. As a result, Jackson swiftly forced the Spanish to surrender its army and the British to return to Prospect Bluff.
Despite Nichols's failure to defend Pensacola, the British and their black and native allies maintained their military service commitment to defend the southern frontier from the United States.
There is a long tradition in slave societies, both Atlantic world ones And then going back to Rome between those who could fight and those who couldn't. And being able to fight was something you aspired to do. And it was empowering, gave you a sense of dignity, self-worth. And it also oftentimes led to freedom, or if you had achieved freedom, greater iterations of freedom, more rights, more liberty. People, not everybody, obviously, it'd be too much of a generalization, but oftentimes enslaved men, and certainly in a situation like this, embrace the opportunity to become soldiers, and again, to free their bodies, but also their minds in a very deep way. But then also the practical implications of this. A lot of these men would have known how to fight. They would have been good with rifles. During their time with Nichols, they received formal cutting-edge military training. So I think in terms of their identity, not only does it solidify the sense of Britishness, but it also gives a strong sense of being strong, secure in their position, their physical position, and being a potentially fearsome military antagonist for the American invasion, which everybody knows is going to come at some point.
Number one, if they had any doubts that they were men, that's confirmed here, but also equally important, they are Britons. And we have to be careful with this. You know, some historians make a huge point of saying that they developed this British identity, and I don't disagree, but I still think that for them, this is strategic, and they are aligning themselves with the Brits, because the Brits are obviously trying to help them. But I really think just that military service gives them a little bit of pride, or just enough pride, you know, just enough support to maybe go the extra mile to fight to maintain their freedom. I mean, they've shown what they can accomplish. They have impressed the Brits and the British officers, several of them during this time period. They write about how these recruits are so much better than the European or the English recruits. And so for an African-American to hear that, and they've been told that they're inferior, they've been treated as slaves, obviously, but then you're recruited by the British and you're told that you are superior to these other combatants, it's got to be really emboldening. So I think there's a personal commitment or affirmation of who they are. And it certainly, I think, inspires them to continue fighting for their freedom and the freedom of people like them.
The free Black and Native peoples at Prospect Bluff relied on their military experience and identity sooner than they anticipated.
A crushing British defeat in the Battle of New Orleans in January 1815 prompted an official end to the War of 1812, curbing plans to launch a full-scale invasion of the southern frontier from Prospect Bluff.
The war will conclude before they are ever able to act. Had the Battle of New Orleans gone well for the British, that would have put them in a very good position to basically expand this invasion of the Gulf South into Georgia with the assistance of Black and Indigenous allies.
The British will start to pull their troops out in the spring and early summer of 1815. At the same point, many of their Creek allies, Native American allies, they decide that we're done with the British. Like, we have fought alongside them. We have trusted them. We have believed in them. We have been hopeful with them. But this is our second crushing defeat, the American Revolution and now the War of 1812, alongside them. And so while many Creek warriors will stay at the Bluff for a couple of months, they slowly but surely start to fade away. And they start to move eastward towards East Florida. They start to join with the Seminoles. And again, they will fight for decades. But what happens at the British post is you're left with several hundred veteran Black colonial Marines who decide to stay, their families who decide to stay, and just a handful of Choctaw Indians. And that's pretty much it. And that's when Benjamin Hawkins labels it Negro Fort. Because the vast majority of almost, there's like one white Briton who stays, but almost all British soldiers leave, almost all Native Americans leave, and it's really just a fort controlled by escaped slaves, most who had fought for the colonial Marines.
As the British withdrew from the area, Nichols planned to relocate the entire community to various British colonies in the Caribbean, maintaining their status as free people.
Yet, these plans fell through after Nichols claimed they did not have enough boats to transport everyone.
On my leave in the post at the Bluff in June 1815, I had not transport sufficient to take away 350 men, women, and children, the former of whom had enlisted in the British forces. But they had agreed to keep together, under protection of Indian chiefs, until we had an opportunity of sending for them. I promised to return in 6 months to transport the former slaves to the British Empire.
As a result, the British decided to leave their Black and Indigenous allies at Prospect Bluff. with a pledge that they would return with the fortifications intact and, more alarmingly to Americans, with their weapons.
The plan is to relocate everybody probably to Trinidad, but they don't have enough boats and they don't have enough space. So Nichols says in the spring of 1815, you're British subjects. This is your territory. I don't know when we'll be back, but we'll be back to pick you up. Until then, you're heavily armed. Remember what we taught you. Remember your status. Good chance the Americans are going to come and get you. But be ready, be prepared. We'll probably be back. London learns about this. Officials in the Caribbean learn about this. And they say there's no chance in hell you're going back to pick up a community of formerly emancipated slaves. And as a result, the community says, okay, we're here permanently. And they probably never give up hope that someday Nichols will return. But they are connected enough with the Spanish to know what's happening officially. And then to make the assumption that this is now our home.
A lot of it comes down to Nichols. If Cochrane had been on the ground, I think he probably would have said, this is our stuff. It belongs to the British military. We're going to keep this stuff. To my African American and Native American allies, I thank you for your service, but the battle continues elsewhere. But I think it's because Nichols seems to be a legit egalitarian. And apparently Nichols claims that they couldn't all fit on the ship, all these slaves. And I think that might be true, but I actually would argue that they didn't want to go. And that gets back to the question of British identity. I think a lot of these slaves, and we know for a fact that some of them didn't trust the British completely, and the British still practiced slavery in the Caribbean and things of that nature. So I think a lot of these slaves were very content to be left with control of the fort, you know, several hundred muskets, several hundred barrels of gunpowder and shot, dozens of cannon, a bunch of, you know, boats and schooners and things of that nature. So I think they were more than satisfied to be left alone in this fortress in the Florida wilderness.
Nichols never returned to the fort.
Instead, the people at Prospect Bluff continued to carve out their own ideals of freedom and autonomy along the Apalachicola River, where they lived as a self-sufficient community for the next year.
Once the British formally withdrew in July 1815, the remaining inhabitants of the fort constituted a Maroon community. Maroon communities existed in the Americas as early as the first decade after European contact.
A Maroon community is normally understood to be an autonomous settlement of formerly enslaved people who fled their bondage or were actually abducted by other Maroons, liberated in some cases. And these communities become common across the Americas, beginning as early as the late 1490s with the introduction of slavery and, in this case, Spanish colonialism. The overarching commonality of Maroons is that they were efforts by usually people of African descent, sometimes in conjunction with Native people or Europeans, to resist and reject slavery and create autonomous societies. They almost always were created in remote and inhospitable locations outside the plantation complex because they were inherently defensive. They were looked at as a threat to slavery, a spur to slave resistance. So they, from their very inception, be they two people or 2,000 people, always really troubled enslavers, colonial officials who usually worked for their destruction. So they sought to be invisible, to disengage as much as was possible. Never fully possible.
From the earliest days of the colonial period, we're talking the 1500s, large numbers of Africans would escape in the Americas, typically the Caribbean islands, Central America. And so Maroon becomes a term applied to small, typically, you know, pockets or communities of escaped slaves during the era of the Atlantic slave trade. And all over the Americas, from the west coast of Africa to the Caribbean to South and Central America and eventually Florida.
Prospect Bluff fit the definition of a typical Maroon community. But because it existed near the southern periphery of the United States, contained a large supply of powerful weapons, and had historical ties to the British Empire, the fort also developed into an exceptional Maroon community.
These same attributes began to transform Prospect Bluff into Negro Fort.
Negro Fort is a community of escaped slaves. So right there fits the definition of a Maroon colony. But what makes it very different is, and anybody who studied Negro Fort, this is inescapable, there's never been a community of Maroons given so many military supplies, so many uniforms, so many weapons, so many vessels, so many cannon. I mean, it's just unprecedented. And so for them to have, like I said, hundreds of barrels of gunpowder and shot, hundreds of muskets and what they called stand of arms. So it wasn't just the gun, it was all the accessories that you needed to fire these things. To have boats, to have cannon, even the uniforms, they had boxes and crates full of red coats. It was incredible. So they really were given advantages that no other Maroon community had ever had or would ever have in the history of slavery in the Americas.
It's not totally isolated. It's formed by some Maroons and some indigenous people, but fortified by a major political power in that way is not so common.
Not just a major political player, Great Britain boasted one of the most powerful militaries in the world.
As a result, the fort at Prospect Bluff that British soldiers and their allied Black and Native troops built remained an impressive and robust structure even after the British left in July 1815.
The original site is about 5, 6, 7 acres large, and I've been there multiple times, walked it multiple times, measured it a couple of times. And so this entire area is surrounded by this moat with this wooden stockade. There's two large bastions, which are like these towers where you'll have soldiers. But what happens towards the end of the War of 1812, around 1815, you're going to get built in the middle of this site what Nicholas is going to call a citadel. And this is just this massive inner fort. So it's an octagonal-shaped fort made of literally earth and wood. So it's these huge chopped-down trees, these huge logs with a bunch of mud and dirt. And they're stacked up, and you build this octagonal fort that's about, I think it's like 150 feet diameter. And inside of it, you have a couple of barracks and storage facilities. And you have this huge place to store, they call it a magazine, to store gunpowder. We're talking hundreds of barrels of gunpowder. This becomes sort of the center of Negro Fort. And outside of it, you have more barracks, you have more storage facilities, you have huts where some of these people and their families would live.
It was a pretty standard British design, kind of middling size fort, built from locally available timber, obviously, dug out big trenches around it, faithfully a powder magazine in the middle of it, high wooden walls built on the banks of the Apalachicola River, one of the major thoroughfares of the southeast, placed at an absolutely critical strategic junction by the British. It's near a place where Creeks and Seminoles meet to do business with the British, so it is in multiple different ways a highly strategic location. It is both remote, but then also central through different networks of communication.
This combination of seclusion and interaction with nearby indigenous populations continued to benefit the community at the fort after the war. They often traded with networks of Native Americans for food and supplies. They also harnessed the geography and ecology of the area, using their proximity to the Apalachicola River to grow crops, fish, and hunt.
In terms of the physical geography, it is still very, very remote. Water provides the main thoroughfare, so too well-worn trails and paths that all throughout the entire region. It is thickly forested. The forest teem with life, as does the river for feeding people. It also is conducive to agriculture once it's cleared and planted. So it ends up being, in terms of a place to form a Maroon community, it's pretty much ideal. It compares very well to other Maroons in different locations. It may even be kind of advantageous. Some Maroons are, you know, in swamps where it's difficult to grow stuff, and in mountains where it's difficult to grow stuff, even more remote. So in terms of geography and in ecology, it is pretty ideal.
Surrounding the fort, north of the fort and south of the fort alongside the river, you have hundreds of escaped slaves, so some of the family members, and they have farms, what one American soldier calls plantations. And he said that they go 50 miles up the river. And I certainly believe there were a lot of acres of land alongside the river where these Maroons, these escaped slaves, they have this property to themselves for a year. And I'm sure they have crops planted for at least many miles alongside the river.
Mm-hmm.
quite a thing to imagine living in the forest of West Florida 200 years ago. Big insects and alligators, and it would be a challenging physical environment to live in.
But the inhabitants of the fort at Prospect Bluff inherited valuable knowledge and materials from the British that helped them thrive as an autonomous community.
Very few, if any, Maroon communities in the Americas enjoyed the same resources and evolved in the same way.
Its material advantages are, if not unique, extremely unusual in comparative perspective. The British left a massive amount of most importantly, weapons and ammunition and powder, but also pots, kettles, axes, things that you need to survive in the wilderness. This is an immense benefit to the community. Most Maroons are survivalist entities who people just escape with the shirts on their backs, and then they have to steal, they raid, they trade for goods that the Prospect Bluff community has in spades. And when other Maroon communities have to try to acquire goods, it oftentimes leads to conflicts and their destruction. So this is a huge advantage that the community enjoys. It allows them to really disengage from white society. They don't need guns. They don't need this and that. And they can pick and choose who to interact with.
As a result, the community at the fort developed a rich autonomous society informed by enslaved people's own ethnic diversity and lived experiences. The movement of black people around the Atlantic world meant that the inhabitants of the fort carried with them a great variety of social and cultural identities. The material and geographic advantages of Prospect Bluff allowed these diverse backgrounds to prosper and coalesce.
The formation and cultivation of families, social bonds, the practicing of religion, networks of community, storytelling. And my way of imagining Prospect Bluff is that it would be a really vibrant place, also because of the ethnic diversity of it. It is both Afro-diasporic, but again, in the broadest possible sense. French stories, Caribbean stories, African stories, Georgia, different languages, dialects, indigenous people coming and going. I mean, it would be an acutely diverse place of multiple cultural sensibilities, experiences, ages, but with this guiding principle of freedom, and protecting freedom at all costs, and we've earned this, and this is our community, and it's a autonomous, free, earned community in the Atlantic borderlands at the tail end of the Age of Revolution.
The diversity of enslaved experiences in the early 19th century also meant that when the inhabitants found freedom at Prospect Bluff, they brought with them a variety of skills and expertise that facilitated the survival of the community. Sources created by Spanish officials at the time offer important insight into the varied people who lived at the fort.
Some of them were very, very skilled craftsmen, such as shipbuilders, carpenters. Some of them were literate. And so this is something that people don't think about when they think about rebellion and forts and so on, that some of these were very, very adept figures. One of the other fellows that I find that was taken from a Florida plantation ends up in the Suwannee is a fellow called Nero, Polydor, Abraham, Sebastian. They all had particularly interesting backgrounds. The Commander Garçon, as you can tell by the French name, is coming out of Saint-Domingue, which makes him actually very scary.
In 1791, the beginning of a violent insurrection by enslaved people against white colonial administrators in Haiti, then known as the French colony of Saint-Domingue, led to the Haitian Revolution, one of the only successful slave rebellions in history. Garçon's connection to Haiti provoked memories of the violence of the Haitian Revolution in the minds of some white people. He also contributed to the fort's sustainability alongside the other inhabitants.
Garçon was a 30-year-old carpenter from Saint-Domingue. There was another 30-year-old carpenter, Tom, who was valued at 700 pesos. 23-year-old Agustin, valued at 500 pesos. Harry was a caulker and a navigator, knew how to read and write, and he was valued at 2,000 pesos, which is really a lot. And Abraham, master carpenter, valued at 1,000 pesos. There were even some African-born people, Congo, Carlos Mayumbe. So these are not necessarily people who could be bamboozled into serving. They made choices. They knew how to read the political winds. These are people who had skills, had languages, had value.
Not everyone in the region viewed the inhabitants of the fort in this way.
Threatened by their skills and the autonomy they afforded, American slave owners felt compelled to attack the inhabitants of the fort and control this value for themselves.
What the real threat is, by the end of this War of 1812, as this Negro fort emerges, the growing threat is black people. It's black slaves thinking they have a right to freedom, black people having access to firearms. It's utterly terrifying to Southern planters.
The term Negro fort is an American construct.
Applied to the community at Prospect Bluff, it illuminates a deep ideology of racial fear felt by many Southern planters of the period.
In 1815, American slave owner and statesman Benjamin Hawkins first used the term to describe the fort.
Benjamin Hawkins, he's this powerful bureaucrat, but as he reaches middle age, he's a planter. That is his identity. He is a deep South planter in Southern Georgia. And so when he says this fort is now a Negro fort, he is speaking to like-minded people. He's sending a message. Today we call it a dog whistle, right? It's this idea that this is a fort controlled by black people, which almost implies we, the United States, we have to act on this. We can't stand for this.
Hawkins's use of the term Negro fort resonated with other slave owners across the South because it highlighted the rigidly defined but ultimately imaginary racial hierarchy that characterized Southern society in the early 19th century.
That term was a label created by American enslavers, American officials, for very particular loaded reasons. It is both designed to underscore the racialized menace to slavery that was embodied by a free black community, fort, the militaristic piece of the puzzle, and Negro unambiguously about race. This is Andrew Jackson and people like this trying to name and other and create a menace in using all the semantic tools that they would have had.
Like, blackness is so anathema to what they are endeavoring to accomplish economically and regarding geography and expansion and all that stuff. It's code word, right? If this is a Negro fort, it's got to go.
This fortification, occupied by formerly enslaved black Southerners, flies in the face of the status quo of what is an expanding plantation South.
And it's just the whole idea of black people having a fort, having weapons. It is so contrary to everything a Southern Deep South planter stands for that it is a whistle being blown that we need to come together and we need to eliminate this thing as quickly as possible. We won't stand for it.
The labeling of this fortification as the Negro fort versus something more neutral in a lot of ways is a politicization of this maroon colony, that it is used to highlight the fact that there are black Southerners in their own fortification with guns and ammunition. Not far from basically the United States border. And it is going to be a term that will sort of inflame passions of white Southerners, not just in this border region, but across the South, who are very much invested in this racial hierarchy of the region.
Andrew Jackson was one of these people. As a Southern slave owner, he sympathized with the planter class who felt threatened by the organized and armed black presence at the fort.
I have very little doubt of the fact that this fort has been established by some villains for the purpose of murder, raping, and plunder, and that it ought to be blown up regardless of the ground it stands on.
The Southern presses will put out there that this is a refuge for basically enslaved black Southerners to seek out across much of this area. So there will be continued raids by Red Sticks across the Florida-Georgia border, across the Florida-Alabama border. And there are going to be calls from white Georgians in the South for basically federal intervention.
Jackson's national reputation following his victories against the Creeks in 1814 and at the Battle of New Orleans in January 1815 increasingly encouraged white Southerners living near the Florida border to look to Jackson to confront what they viewed as the material and ideological threat of Negro Fort.
As soon as the Battle of New Orleans is over, frontier settlers, politicians, there's a congressman, there's a judge, and they're just writing letters to Washington, D.C. saying, send in Andrew Jackson. We got problems down here. Send us Andrew Jackson. He's got this reputation after the Creek War of being a frontier warrior. And certainly after the Battle of New Orleans, he's got this ragtag group of troops that he puts together at the last minute and crushes the British. So I think for a lot of people across the United States, the Deep South, these planters, he's one of them. Yet he's also this emerging American warrior who can defeat people down here. He can defeat people like the ones the British are aligning with. Just send Andrew Jackson. And Jackson will volunteer himself as well.
Jackson's near genocidal views about Native Americans also influenced his anxiety over the community at Negro Fort. His persistent pursuit to invade Spanish Florida and push the indigenous populations out of the peninsula remained a constant ambition. Many southern slave owners shared this desire as they eyed Spanish Florida as a region suitable for the expansion of American slavery. And the manufactured threat Negro Fort posed offered a fortuitous opportunity for southern sympathizers like Jackson.
In a lot of ways, we see that the sustainability of what becomes referred to, not just by U.S. officials, but in the press as well as the Negro Fort, is a challenge to the racial hierarchy of the American South. If there is going to be an effective maroon colony that is well-armed and potentially well-defended, that there is concern that it then will basically encourage indigenous people to continue resisting U.S. expansion as well.
Eager to invade the Florida Peninsula once more and eliminate a community that undermined his vision of a racialized order, Jackson often spoke about the inhabitants of the fort in militant terms as a justification to do so.
Under whose authority has this fort been established? Whose subjects do they profess to be? If they profess to be subjects of a power with whom we are at peace, their acts are acts of war and ought to be made the subject of demand for redress by our government. If they are banditti, assembled in the territory of Spain, or claim to be the subjects of any other power and are stealing and enticing away our Negroes, they are to be viewed as a band of outlaws, land pirates, and ought to be destroyed.
Jackson also used this belligerent and racialized language about the fort and its people in his correspondence with Mauricio de Zuniga, the Spanish governor of West Florida. Jackson's attempts to contact the Spanish governor during the spring of 1816 reflected his growing desire to invade the foreign territory.
Sir, I am charged by mine government to make known to you that a Negro fort erected during our late war with Britain has been strengthened since that period and is now occupied by upwards of 250 Negroes, many of whom have been enticed away from their service or their masters, citizens of the United States, all of whom are well clothed and disciplined. This banditti and the hostile Creeks are sending recruiting parties into Georgia and threatening the safety of the southern frontier. This is a state of things which cannot fail to produce much injury into the neighboring settlements and excite irritations which may eventually endanger the peace of the nation. The conduct of the banditti is such as will not be tolerated by our government, and if not put down by Spanish authority, will compel us in defense to destroy them.
He says it's self-defense. They basically accuse, there's a couple settlers who were killed along the Florida border in this time period, and every time their lives are taken, Jackson and people like him will blame it on Negro Fort. There's no evidence to suggest anybody from Negro Fort had anything to do with this handful of murders. It's just frontier violence, quite frankly. But if a Native American was involved, Jackson and people like him, they say, well, it must be the Indians aligned with Negro Fort. So they make an argument that these people are killing Americans, they're crossing the border, coming to kill more Americans. So as an act of self-defense, self-preservation, we must invade Spanish Florida.
The invasion of Negro Fort by Jackson-led forces began on July 15, 1816.
The Americans devised a three-pronged approach to open their assault. First, the American troops and their allied Creek warriors established a fortification near the junction of the Apalachicola River and the U.S.-Florida border, called Camp Crawford. This allowed the U.S. forces to monitor Negro Fort and eventually launch their attack.
Second, a U.S. Navy convoy shipped supply vessels and gunboats from the Louisiana coast to the mouth of the Apalachicola River and finally upstream to Camp Crawford.
Third and lastly, one of the U.S. Army boats planned to escort the naval convoy as they ascended to the camp.
With this illicit traffic along the Apalachicola River in Spanish Florida, the American forces hoped to bait the inhabitants of the fort to fire upon them, intending to instigate a confrontation with the Maroons at Negro Fort.
If the Maroons fired first, then the American convoy could retaliate in self-defense and shield Jackson from possible controversy invading a foreign territory.
There's going to be a camp set up. The establishment of this fortification to both keep an eye on the Negro Fort and to try and deter continued raids by Native Americans on white Southern settlers means that to access it, the U.S. Navy has to go by sea.
One group is going to come south from Georgia down the Apalachicola River. There's 250 Creek warriors and maybe 100 American soldiers from the U.S. Army. And the soldiers get in boats and they start floating down the river. And at the same time, you're going to have several gunboats who had come over from Louisiana and several schooners, U.S. Navy forces, maybe 100 men, and they're going to sail up the river. And the goal is to meet coming from north in the river and coming up from south from the Gulf of Mexico.
Everybody who seems to be involved in this is very well aware that if they sail up the Apalachicola River, they're basically going to be under fire by the Maroon colony at Prospect Bluff. And it is very clear that they are baiting the inhabitants to basically fire upon them so that they can have cause to engage with this outpost that, by the way, is in a foreign country. It is U.S. Navy sailing up a river in Spanish territory to basically try and spark a conflict with the occupants of this fort.
Americans had been going illicitly up these rivers already with their navies, again, under kind of covert approval of the American government. But they really had no declaration of war. They shouldn't have been there. That was still Spanish territory. There had been no government negotiations to turn over any of that territory to Americans. So they're there illicitly.
So when the U.S. Navy begins sailing up the Apalachicola River, they do so not just with supply ships, but with gunships as well. When they approach, they are fired upon and they return fire.
There is a battle for a handful of days. It appears that a large amount of would-be potential defenders are both away hunting, and there's already been kind of an evacuation of a large amount of the community members. So the fort is undermanned when this large American and Creek invasion comes.
It's about a three-week-long affair. At first, three sailors are killed on the southern stretch of the river. A fourth guy will be killed after he's tortured. And those are the first casualties of this battle. Also on the northern stretch of the river, we're going to have some lives taken. We're going to have some slaves who are captured by the American soldiers and basically taken into custody. And then eventually when these two forces arrive at Negro Fort, there's a siege takes place. And for several weeks, what happens from sunup to sundown is American sailors are bombarding the fort from the river. You have Creek warriors just firing guns, sort of attacking the fort. On a couple occasions, there's some hand-to-hand combat between some of the Maroons and some of the Creek warriors.
During the sunup to sundown bombardment of the fort, the American forces miscalculated the difficulty they faced capturing the area.
And what's often overlooked in this whole engagement is a regiment that will try and negotiate a surrender of the fort.
The same racialized views that caused the American forces to fear the black autonomy embodied by the fort also led them to believe that eliminating its inhabitants would be easy. But Garcon's leadership and defense of the fort proved otherwise.
Garcon, he informed a Creek delegation that the Americans sent. He had been left in command of the fort by the British government and that he would sink any American vessels that should attempt to pass it. The indigenous leaders, as well as the black leaders, knew that if they didn't fight to the end, they were going to be executed in one way or another.
The occupants of the fort realized that they can't just surrender. If they do, they'll be re-enslaved, or if they were free from the beginning, they will likely be enslaved. So it isn't exactly an option for the occupants of this fortification.
In his resolve to defend the freedom of the fort and its inhabitants, Garçon hoisted the red flag of no surrender.
For people like Polydor, Abraham, and others who lived freely at the fort over the past year, the red flag of no surrender that emerged through the smoke of the battle symbolized their commitment to life and liberty over bondage.
He had put up a red flag under the British flag, which was indicative of, we will not give any quarter, nor will we surrender. And so he basically knew that was going to be his result.
And then ultimately, a cannonball that is heated in a little furnace is fired from one of the American gunboats. And so they dropped this heated hotshot, they called it, right in the middle of the citadel, where you have hundreds of barrels of gunpowder.
According to naval officers who are involved in this assault, say that they basically fire on the fort. There is a hot shot, sort of infamously hits the powder kegs.
And as you can imagine,
blows the whole thing sky high.
The fort itself is almost completely incinerated. A handful of survivors are captured. Some are executed.
The United States military will report upwards of 300 inhabitants will be killed in the explosion. Southern newspapers are going to report some pretty gruesome and horrific sort of retellings of body parts and limbs supposedly hanging in trees, with the death of men, women, and children as a result of this engagement.
It was an unprecedented explosion that some people claimed you could hear in Pensacola, 100-something miles away. So it was a massive ground-shaking event that killed almost all of the fort's inhabitants in a matter of minutes.
What happens is, after all this defiance with the flags and failure for them to surrender, this explosion happens, and it just pretty much totally destroys everything. It had to have been terribly horrible, and even the Americans were kind of horrified by what they saw afterwards in the aftermath. There's not much that survives.
But at this same moment,
the memory of Negro Fort begins. Thanks for listening to the Memory of Negro Fort podcast. We're your hosts, Sebastian Garcia
and John Lancaster.
The Memory of Negro Fort podcast is hosted by the UCF Center for Humanities and Digital Research, with additional support from a gift that was made as an extension of the American Historical Association's Sinclair Workshops for Historical Podcasting.
This episode of the Memory of Negro Fort podcast is researched, written, and edited by your hosts, Sebastian Garcia and John Lancaster.
Special thanks to Barbara Gannon in her graduate colloquium and seminar classes, Scott French, Jim M. Buskey, Jeanette Patrick, Crystal M. Moden, Jackie Wilver, Kristen Weatherby, Brian Martin, Heather Gibson, Jamie Ackenberger, Amelia Lyons, Amy Giroux, Brooke Miller, Jacob Ivey, Jennifer Ivey, Lisa Mills, and David Morden.
Our thanks to F. Evan Noe, Matthew Clavin, Nathaniel Malott, and Jane Landers for their expertise throughout this episode. We also thank our voice actors, Kevin Garcia, Richard Weber, Brooks Newsom, and Maddie Poston.
Subscribe to the Memory of Negro Fort podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you again for listening, and until next time.